He rose from a sharecropper family in rural Arkansas to the pinnacle of American pop culture, a singer for the ages and a musician's musician. This hour, I'm talking about Glen Campbell with his daughter Ashley, longtime sideman Carl Jackson, and filmmaker James Keach, who documented Campbell's final tour and his life with Alzheimer's disease. I'm Craig Havockhurst, and this is The String. Alzheimer's disease is a catastrophic mental illness affecting about 1 in 9 people over the age of 65. That's more than 5 million cases in the U.S. But if you haven't been close to a loved one with the disease, the reality of living with it can be abstract. That's why I'll Be Me, the 2014 documentary about Glen Campbell's experience with the disease, is so revelatory and moving. When we first see the artist and Kim, his wife since 1982, receive the Alzheimer's diagnosis at the start of the film, it's clear that Glen's connection to his past is fading away. But the film quickly pivots to the dramatic difference when he's on stage. Campbell's voice and delivery are magnificent. He can play guitar like the master he's always been. And thus is launched the story of a 2.5-year tour during which he and his fans bid one another an emotional farewell.
Thank you for coming out here. Because it just... And with my family, and it's kind of cool. I've tried and I have failed, Lord. I've won and I have lost.
This performance from the Ryman Auditorium here in Nashville is on the soundtrack to I'll Be Me. The family Glen refers to includes three of his children in the band, sons Cal and Shannon, and daughter Ashley, a singer, keyboardist, and banjo player. She's one of my guests in this hour. Ashley is 29 years old and pursuing a music career of her own. Joining the conversation is Carl Jackson, a veteran Nashville producer, songwriter, and musician who was on tour with Glen from 1972 to 1984. He's also Ashley's godfather and musical mentor. Later on, I speak with James Keach, director of I'll Be Me, about the challenge and emotion of capturing Glen Campbell's struggles and performing triumphs in those last 2 years of touring, and rounding out the hour, some archival tape of Glen himself at the dawn of his fame in 1969. Now, here's my conversation with Ashley Campbell and Carl Jackson.
The film required a lot of courage and a lot of, on Glen's part, the family's part, a lot of trust. So what led to you all accepting this invitation to be followed and filmed in an intimate way and sharing this experience with the world?
Well, it started off with Julian Raymond, who produced my dad's last couple records, and he's a close family friend now, and he knew James Keach, the director and producer, very well, and so he brought James into our lives, and you know, James was already starting to become like family. We had hung out with him a lot, and you know, we kind of just trusted him, and my dad wanted to do it, so you know, he was the leader, and we said, okay, let's go.
Were there ground rules? Was there a sense that you could put the brakes on the intimacy and the exposure and the if need be? How did you manage that, your mom, your family, and yourself?
Absolutely. You know, our first and foremost concern was never to compromise his dignity and his image, you know, to show the human side of him without ever showing anything that would be too embarrassing or, you know, something that he wouldn't want anyone to see. Because a lot of the time, you know, with Alzheimer's, they don't really realize that they're forgetting a lot of stuff. So we just, you know, nothing that would make us feel uncomfortable, but enough to show the malevolence of the disease, you know?
Good word.
And of course, you know, everything was with pre-approval. So James knew that, and we trusted him as well, that he would never do anything that we didn't approve of. But of course, we got to see everything before it was ever released.
How much of it was a memory journey for you? The video you made of your song Remembering, is we see you watching home movies. How much of a memory journey was making this film for you?
You know, it's priceless to have the time that I got to spend with my dad after we found out that he had Alzheimer's, to have it documented and to be able to go back and watch actual video footage and you know, see him perform and see me performing with him. I haven't actually seen the documentary in a while because it got a little too real for me. And but I've seen it many, many times, and each time, like, it made me feel happier than sad, because I know that I have that footage forever and that I can look back whenever, because now my dad is pretty far gone with the disease, and it's really difficult to see, to look at him and see who he used to be now. It's very painful for me to go and visit him right now, actually. But I do. So the documentary is a real treasure for me.
Carl, what was your window on the film and on Glenn's illness, having known him so long?
Well, Glenn is, I can only put things really simply that I love Glenn Campbell. I got involved in the film just a little bit, after it had already started and everything. James asked me to help line up some interviews with people in town and stuff like that. And, of course, everybody adores Glenn Campbell, so that wasn't a really hard thing to do. And it was very nice of James to make me an associate producer and all that stuff. But it's just to see all that stuff brings back so many memories for me. Going with Glenn in 1972, staying with him for, I always tell people, 12 of the very best years of my life, traveling all around the world with him. It means so much to me to have that memory in my life and to be able to still see him and be a part of the family. I mean, this young lady's my goddaughter, and I love her more than I have words to say. Mm-hmm. And so it's an emotional thing, But I'm thankful that I had that experience, That time when I was with Glenn, it was like he was the ultimate, still the ultimate as far as I'm concerned, the greatest singer God ever put on this earth, period. Not to mention great musician and just great person. So good to me. So many things, as my answer is going, so many things just go off in my mind when you even mention the name Glenn Campbell, and they're all good.
Well, tell us about the persona that we miss in the film. Tell us about the parts that what was the, well, we see a lot of that kind of wit and desire to playfulness, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. We see that for sure. Well, but what was he like?
That was always there. Glenn was the guy that I think I was with him for 12 years, like I say, and if I remember correctly, I told him one joke that he hadn't heard, and that he was so funny, he would let you tell him a joke, and like you just think you're going to get him really good, and you get right to the punchline, and he'd say it.
Okay.
He would, and it's like it almost never failed. One of the funniest guys ever. And he made you, he wasn't your boss, man. He was just one of you, I mean, we were included on everything. I mean, the kind of guy that, gives you per diem, but then takes you out to eat constantly every day and refuses to let you pay for anything. And he never acted like a star,
Really?
He was just one of the guys. I mean, I don't know things I'm supposed to bring up or whatever, but I literally can remember one time Glenn and I were playing golf together in Las Vegas, and Glenn's very first marriage, he had a son that passed away.
Really?
That would be my age. And he just looked over at me, we'd been playing golf together, and he goes, I had a son that passed away be your age, and he says, I want you to know, you can always be here as long as you want to.
Wow.
And things like that that just flooded into my mind. There's so many memories like that of where Glenn's family, Ashley's family, Kim's family, Cal, Shannon.
Yeah.
This is just a special, special person that we're talking about.
So Ashley, you would think of him as a man who could make really personal connections even amid a very high-paced, lots of people, lots of activity.
Absolutely.
Kind of life.
Just about every single fan that I've talked to that people come and see my shows, or that even during the tour when I would be packing up my instruments at the lip of the stage and people would come up and talk to me and they would tell me stories about when they saw him back in the day and blah, blah, blah. And they said he would always, no matter how busy he was or in a rush he was, he would make sure he shook every hand and took every picture and said hello to everyone
always
before he left. He never was too big for his fans.
From the very first day that I was with him.
That's what people say to me constantly, is that he was just the most personable person, and he cared so deeply for personal connections.
He never even seemed bothered. Like we could be in a restaurant somewhere.
Mm-hmm. He'd have a mouthful of food, and someone would just come up to him and it didn't say, "Oh my gosh, Glenn Campbell." He'd be like, "Thank you."
Thank you very much. You know? He was just he treated everybody with respect.
Wow.
He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
I was surprised to reread that there was this long stretch in the 60s where he was a working picker, a working studio musician, mm-hmm. but he was simultaneously trying to get out there as an artist and making records, even for Capitol, I believe.
Yeah.
But nothing going on. And he persevered. What do you know about that period of his life?
Well, I mean, Glenn was, he was a part of the Wrecking Crew. I mean, Glenn was the most sought after guitar player in Los Angeles. I mean, he played on everything. He played on Strangers in the Night. I mean, heck, he was a Beach Boy for a year. He filled in for Brian for a complete year. Playing bass. Now, imagine playing bass and singing the high part. You know, his talent just was amazing. He was first call. I've heard so many demos that the guy sang. You know, I think his first record, I believe, was Universal Soldier. I think I'm right there. And that one was not a big hit. Or it might have been Turn Around, Look at Me.
It might have been. And he sang background vocals on a lot of Merle Haggard stuff.
Oh, he sang background vocals on almost every Haggard hit.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yes, Carolina, man might do that sometimes. I mean, just listen to that record. And
you can hear him.
You'll know now that you
fugitive.
Know it's him. I mean, Lonesome Fugitive. Oh. All those things were Glenn and Bonnie Owens.
Okay.
And you can literally pick him out once you know it's Glenn, you know.
Yeah.
But he's just the best, you know. I mean, what else can you say? Part of the Wrecking Crew, so there
mm-hmm,
you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he continued to keep hacking away at the problem of being an artist and the challenge of being an artist. He didn't sort of say, you know, enough of that. I love my life in the studio. He wanted to be on the road and in front of audiences, apparently.
You know, I wasn't there in 67, 68 when all that stuff was going on. I came on board in 72. Mm-hmm. But I have to believe, I mean, that was just something that it couldn't be denied. I mean, when I say that Glenn Campbell is the greatest singer I've ever heard, I mean, I mean it.
Yeah.
And I've had the honor of singing with a lot of great ones. But, I mean, this guy, you can go back and you can listen to, you can pull up things on YouTube. You can pull up anything you want. I dare you to find me something where you hear one note out of pitch.
He had perfect pitch.
Yeah.
I love this story. It was after he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and we were driving around in Malibu in my mom's car, and he never liked to wear his seatbelt.
Oh.
And so he's sitting in the front, and the little beep, the little seatbelt thing starts beeping. It's like ding, ding, and he goes, "Oh, shut up, A flat."
Exactly.
And I got my phone out and turned on the tone thing, and it was A flat.
It was
amazing.
Oh yeah, many times he would, if it was a cold start or something on a song, I mean, we wouldn't have to hit a key or, you know, a piano note or anything. He'd just start it, and he would be right on.
Part of my heart of hearts is hoping I just sang an A flat, but I'm not.
Right.
I'm not at all confident that I did. But that would be cool. Whoever's checking, let me know.
We'll tune it.
Probably
in
not.
We'll tune it in post.
Yeah, I'm not that.
Fantastic. It may have been waiting for the right song. So Gentle on My Mind comes along.
Yeah.
And I was also surprised to realize that wasn't a smash hit at the time. Top 30 or so, but not a big number one or top 10. But the song that he now opened the shows with absolutely signature.
It set the wheels in motion for sure. Absolutely.
Do you all, I mean, we know how he knew Hartford from television working and Hartford worked a Good Time Hour.
Right.
But how did this, you know, the origins of how the song got into his.
I truly don't. I don't know that. I can't answer it honestly. I don't know. Maybe again, that's just one of those songs. You know, you hear it and it can't be denied.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's maybe he heard a demo or someone else's version of it. Like he heard. Didn't he hear Galveston on the radio? Wasn't it Don Ho?
Well, he might have. He heard Phoenix. I know he heard Johnny Rivers' version of Phoenix.
Yeah.
And that's what
that was the next one.
Yeah.
That was the first big hit.
Yeah.
But he heard Galveston on the radio. Don Ho was doing it as a ballad, and he said, "This isn't a ballad. This is an up-tempo song."
Really?
Yeah.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea waves crashing. While I watch the cannons flashing.
This is The String. I'm Craig Havokhurst. And this hour, we're talking about country and pop phenomenon Glen Campbell, who retired from performing in 2012 after a farewell tour, during which he and his audience knew he was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Galveston was one of his earliest and biggest hit records, part of an incredible run of songs Campbell recorded by songwriter Jimmy Webb. I'm speaking today with Glen's daughter, Ashley, and his longtime friend and side musician, Carl Jackson, about Glen's approach to discovering and working up songs. Carl Jackson was with Glen Campbell when he was considering Rhinestone Cowboy.
Same with Rhinestone Cowboy. You heard a ballad version of that, and he said, I'm going to Campbell this up.
Oh, I can remember Rhinestone Cowboy. We were in Australia, and the airlines had gone on strike. And literally, I mean, we had to drive. Imagine this. We had to drive to Perth, okay?
Oh,
yeah.
I mean, across the outback. And Glen's got the little cassette player back there playing Rhinestone Cowboy over and over, you know, demo of it or whatever. And you think we ought to do this? Think we should do this?
And yes. I'm like, yes, you should.
Yeah, that's a good song, man. Maybe we should do that. It worked out.
What? So you're speaking to him as a thinking like a producer. What was his producer's mind? What did you think about records?
He always referred to himself as a song doctor.
Oh.
He wasn't known for being a big songwriter.
No.
You know, Jimmy Webb wrote most of his hits and John Hartford and blah, blah, blah. But he called himself a song doctor, and he would put his magic touch on a song, you know, because he just knew how he wanted it to sound. And mm-hmm. apparently it was the way a lot of people wanted it to sound.
Yeah. And sometimes it was very subtle what he would do. I mean, you can tell you a little story probably a lot of people don't know, but the next time you listen to Southern Nights, listen to it and see if you don't notice that it's just maybe he sounds just a little bit different than usual. And it's because he insisted on VSOing the tape up. We didn't cut it quite fast enough where Glen wanted it. And so he just, rather than recutting it, he solved that. He said, man, I'm just going to crank this up here a little bit. If you listen to it, you can kind of tell once you know, but it's not right on perfect pitch, believe me.
Okay. Yeah. So you're in the band from 72 to 84.
That's correct.
And this is a period full superstardom. And what did that feel like? How big an entourage and how much privacy or lack thereof? And how did Glen ride that wave? We know some of it was not entirely smooth on his part, but
yeah, there were some moments later in that time that weren't so smooth. You're correct, but. I don't know. Again, Glen just made you feel so at home. I mean, you know, we flew first class with him. You know, I mean, we were a part of everything, and it was a big time. We play Las Vegas, and the only other acts that even had to open the balcony at the Hilton in Las Vegas was, I believe, Sinatra and Elvis. You know, Glen Campbell was the other one. I mean, that's the only one that could fill it, you know, and we filled it seven nights a week, you know, two shows a night.
Two shows a night.
8 and 12.
Can you imagine a 12 o'clock Glen Campbell show?
Well, yeah, we'd get off stage at 2, you know, every night. And looking back on that, man, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. And he always just made you feel just part of the act. And especially for me, I mean, Glen featured me, you know, on every show for the entire 12 years.
What were your various roles, Carl?
Well, I mean, I played guitar for him. I played banjo. I played mandolin. Played a little fiddle and sung all the harmonies, you know, all the high harmonies above him. I tell people that my voice got really high because I had to start singing above Glen Campbell, you know. I really wasn't known as a tenor singer until being with Glen.
Wow.
But he would put my name. I mean, he put my name on the marquee everywhere
really?
In Vegas. I mean, I look back on that stuff. I'm just talking about things. Not bragging, it's stuff that he didn't have to do, that he did for me. He would leave the stage. I mean, he introduced me, and he would leave the stage for two or three songs, and I would do things with the orchestra or whatever. Then he'd come back out and join me, and we'd do two or three more things every show. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he didn't have to do that. And it meant a lot. I've never forgotten it. I never will. Mm.
You're also speaking of a guy that's playing with strings, playing Vegas, but he comes from the deep country, and he's obviously capable of and loves hillbilly music. But he was the crossover king. What was there a? I'm sure it wasn't discussed much at the time, but was there a kind of a philosophy about music and about the way these things sounded that would ever kind of like this one feels twangier, this one feels more, but the hits we know. Are pretty. They're pop records.
They're kind of pop records, mm-hmm. yeah. Glenn, I can remember him saying he just always was looking for, you know, a good song. He didn't. He was not one to categorize stuff too much. It was just, if it was good, he liked it. And he would say that most of the time on the stage, you know.
Something, and if it wasn't good, if he it would wasn't say good, so.
Yeah, he'd let you know about it if it wasn't good or if he felt it wasn't. And, yeah. And he knew the difference, believe me.
Well, Ashley, let's talk about your musical learning and tutelage here in this, in with this amazing father and a godfather like Carl, who is awfully talented.
Yes.
And when did you begin to play with music, and what got you interested first? Where'd you go with music, and how intensely?
Well, I always liked to sing since I was little. I was really embarrassed about it when I was very little. Like, I remember when my dad had a theater in Branson, Missouri. I think this might have even been before he got his theater. We were at the Grand Palace there, which is like this huge White House-looking theater. And I said, I was 6 years old or something. I said, I want to sing the national anthem. And my dad was like, "Oh, well, sing it for me. Let me see if you've got some pipes." And we were at our house there in Branson, and I made my mom and dad stand outside my bedroom door with the door cracked, and I hid behind my bed on the floor, and I sang the national anthem for them. I was so, like, shy. I started playing guitar when I was 15.
Okay.
And, you know, I wasn't super serious about it then. I was more into, like, theater and acting and things like that.
Oh.
And then I went to college at Pepperdine. And it was kind of like the world saying hint, hint, shove, shove at me. Every role that I got in the Pepperdine Theater Department was because I could play an instrument.
Okay.
I was like, all right, I see something going on here. So then I started playing banjo, and that kind of flipped a switch in my head where I was like, I really love playing music. So I started playing more guitar and banjo and piano. And when I graduated from college, my dad was going on tour to Australia and New Zealand, and I asked if I could tag along. But not even thinking that I would play in the band. And he said, well, you should play in the band. And so I just started touring with him right after college, and it turned into what we know now.
Now, you said I started playing the banjo as if that was just another normal thing that young American kids did. What did hook you to the banjo?
You mean they don't?
A few special ones.
Yeah.
For a very special few. It's the path.
Well, I got cast in a play at Pepperdine where they go every other summer and they take it to London and Scotland and Edinburgh. And I got cast in a play, and they needed like a musician for the play. And they knew I was good at kind of picking up any stringed instrument, being able to kind of play it. And so the director said, hey, Ashley, I'd love for you to learn banjo for this show. Oh. So Pepperdine Theater Department actually paid for my first banjo and first couple lessons. And I just totally fell in love with the banjo and folk music. It's crazy with a dad like Glenn Campbell that I'd never really been introduced to bluegrass music. I was obsessed with the Dixie Chicks Home album in high school, and I didn't even know that was called bluegrass. I was like, oh, I like this country. Yeah. I don't like twangy, like, 90s, much twangy 90s country, but because that's what I had heard, and I was like, eh. Mm-hmm. But I loved the Dixie Chicks Home album, and when I started playing banjo, I was like, oh, that's bluegrass. I like bluegrass. Great. I did improv comedy in Hollywood, and one of my friends, her husband, was a banjo teacher, and so I connected with him, and he was one of my first banjo teachers, and he was in a bluegrass band of also sketch and comedy improvisers. So that's kind of the worlds met, and they were my first like live bluegrass experience. They're called the Dust Bowl Cavaliers, and they're out in California. So,
nice.
So I kind of listened to all their albums and learned to play their songs and all that.
And here you are in Nashville now, just jump ahead. And I imagine that negotiating the end of this long and probably emotionally taxing tour with Glenn Campbell, mm-hmm. and then coming home and going, now I'm going to figure out what I'm doing. Where are we on that journey?
Well, right now I am currently about to make a record in November. I was with Dot Records at Big Machine, but that recently kind of ended. It was like a mutual separation. I wasn't really crazy about the direction that my music was going with them, and so we kind of separated, and now I'm planning on making a full album in November, having my brother Cal produce it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so folks know that so Dot was a revival of an old Nashville label, mm-hmm. but done under the wing of Big Machine, now a major Music Row, mm-hmm. label with a lot of country stars, and probably a mindset where country radio, they might have been thinking country radio because that's where they
yeah.
where they know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the most artistically wide open space right now, as we know.
Yeah.
So I applaud your boldness for saying, let me make my own thing. Yeah.
And
yeah, Carl has been mentoring throughout here. Yeah.
He's got two thumbs up right there.
Yeah. 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 Where do you think this is happening, heading toward, Carl?
I think it's heading toward, I describe it to Ashley like this. She is not an act. She's an artist. And if she has patience, she doesn't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. This girl is a great, great songwriter. She's a great musician. She's a fine, fine singer. And she's one of the sweetest people on the face of this earth. And it's going to happen for her. Mm-hmm. She just has to show that, maybe that Alison Krauss type of patience. Right. Knowing what you want, setting your sights on it, and don't get off that track.
Or Glenn Campbell kind of patience, maybe.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. It's going to happen for her.
Time for a break here on The String. We're listening to our guest Ashley Campbell's debut single, a song from the I'll Be Me documentary soundtrack, and a pure testament to her father. When we come back, Ashley tells us more about walking away from a Nashville record deal to make the debut album she wants to make. Also ahead on the show, filmmaker James Keach on the challenge of making I'll Be Me and Time Machine tape from Glenn himself in 1969. I'm Craig Havokhurst. This is The String from WMOT Roots Radio. We'll be back shortly.